The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. It's the True Wealth Radio Show. Matt, I'm stoked to be here, where we are going to talk about four-letter words today.
Ooh.
We're dropping four-letter words
like crazy.
Don't
get yourself fined, David.
Right?
Don't get yourself fined.
Four-letter word number one, bank.
Ooh, ouch.
Oh,
that's a fine.
Man.
Someone's fining you.
Four-letter word number two, risk.
Ooh, even worse.
We are going to have a beat down on some of this today. You know,
But surprisingly, the market didn't really feel the beat down.
Well, you know, today the markets, they're definitely up. S&P back above 4,000, Dow above 32.5, NASDAQ above 11.8. Solid day in the market.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if this holds tomorrow.
And it was a good day in the banking. Like, if you're just looking at it on a one day look, you know, I mean, banking
did
pretty good today.
Like, you look at bank stocks today and you're like, all right, you know, so you're saying there's a chance, right? Sure.
I'm being optimistic today, David. I'm feeling good.
I will tell you that the markets, this may actually be an interesting sign of the times, right? Consider for a moment that a week ago, we were basically warned that the banking system might fail.
Mm-hmm.
And today, everybody is saying, well, we think the banking system's going to be okay. So maybe it's time to start looking at the future and how the stock market might be bottoming and climbing out of this thing, and the bear market might be ending. And you go, well, that escalated quickly.
It can't it, right? Like, well, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Fed is looking at this and saying, you know, we're partly to blame, I guess you could say, because we raised rates so fast and banks struggled because they had a lot of money loaned out at lower rates, and now the rates are a lot higher really quickly, and it was a shock to the system. So maybe the Fed might start to back off. I mean, I think we're going to get a rate hike this week.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, think that we'll see probably a quarter point tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, we should find out, what is it, 11 o'clock our time, I think, is when they announce something like that. So 1 p.m. Or 2 p.m. Eastern, they'll come out and announce. But and that's not going to surprise me. I haven't gone and looked at the Fed fund futures or anything, but that seems like they're remember, the Fed has a delicate balance here. Some of what they try to do is wordsmith the market into behavior, right? Let's just say the right things, or have the right people go to the right places and say the right things, right? And so they try to manage the message a little bit by, oh, well, we sent one Fed chair off to give a speech somewhere, and they said one thing. We sent somebody else somewhere else, and they said something a little different. And the market's constantly trying to triangulate on the language of the Fed to divine the behavior of the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But at this point, I don't think you're wrong, Matt, that the Fed has contributed somewhat to where the banks are at. I'm sure if they could replay their hand again and wind the clock back, they would say, hey, this inflation thing is more persistent than we thought. It's not just transitory because of COVID shenanigans.
I'm also going to throw the Fed a bone, though, because if we look at it, the Fed had to raise rates because inflation was just going nuts. The banks that failed or are struggling or at risk are largely to blame themselves in this situation because of the fact that they made bad investments on their end.
Oh, I don't blame the Fed for the banks going down.
Right. No,
I actually don't blame
bad
them.
Banking.
And nor do I actually blame regulators or the FDIC wholesale. Right.
Yeah.
And that's because I think many people really want to blame somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And you can find blame. Sure you can, right? Because you're armchair quarterbacking at this point, okay? But it's a lot of people want to look at this, and plus, it's easy and almost fun to blame in some cases because the faceless billionaire is evil. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, and so it started with Silicon Valley Bank. And you're like, well, first of all, Silicon Valley, that's like, you know, billionaire valley. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when everybody's comparing their exotic cars and riding on private jets, you know, you start to feel a little less compassion for a group.
Yes.
You know, because you're like, well, it feels pretty elite. So it's pretty easy to say, well, these are not my people. Right. Like they're not going to associate with me. And therefore, whether that's true or not, I still think billionaires are a lot like regular people in that they still have problems.
Right.
Like their lives are not perfect either. They just have this crazy amount of resource. And you'd think, oh, well, you got this crazy amount of resource, so you could just buy your way out of any problem.
Mm-hmm.
No, not every problem is buyoutable.
Right.
Right. And if you're like, well, I'd like to try it. It's like, no, I get it. And it sounds like it'd be a novel thing to be able to try. But not every problem can be fixed with a checkbook.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of this, I mean, I touched on bad banking, right? Like Credit Suisse, they've been in the news because of all the issues that they've had and now
and
a buyout.
So Credit Suisse, Swiss bank.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
And we've seen in the news that they got bought out by, what was it?
UBS.
And
another Swiss bank, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, because they wanted to stabilize
even
things.
Even bigger Swiss bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But going back to it, I think we sometimes have to just quit looking at someone to blame and say, what if it was just bad business? Because if you look at a timeline of Credit Suisse and their behaviors over the years, I think it's less than favorable. So you can go back and point to a lot of things where you're like, yeah, maybe you just didn't run a good business, and this is the penalty or the product of just not running.
We did not set this up, but Matt, you have walked straight into the topic of the day.
What topic are we talking about?
The four-letter word, which is risk.
Mm.
Okay, we've kind of said this on the program before, but I don't know that we've really given our listeners something to latch on to. And so, and for this one, I hope that listeners come back to this one on podcast as well. So if you're not hearing this live, this podcast, I think it's going to be relevant for a while. And we've talked about before that risk is a ambiguous term a lot of the time when it comes to finance, right? Because it doesn't mean, or because it means so many different things. Risk has different meanings and different contexts in the financial market. They all generally tie together a little bit, but depending on the context, it's going to change the meaning. Okay. So when we think about risk in our lives, we think about things like peril. Okay. That's how insurance views risk. What's the peril? What's the probability of something bad happening?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But risk, that's our insurance company looks at risk and goes, well, how do we need to secure ourselves so that if that risky event occurs, if a peril happens, we have to be able to pay money to restore whatever was broken, right? So now you can't restore a life, but in life insurance, you can say, what's the probability of somebody dying in a big group? And how much money do we need to set aside so that if a person dies and we have to pay life insurance out, we have that much money in our account so that eventually somebody's going to die. And then that person to the insurance company is faceless when they do their calculation. But then when they die, somebody's going to, that life insurance contract's going to pay out. And the insurance company expects that, right? That's their assumption. That's the pricing of risk, is how much premium they charge to the person they are insuring.
Yeah.
And guess what? If you are in a high-risk occupation or if you're in really terrible health and the probability of you dying is higher, it costs more.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how insurance works. It's kind of like if you want to build a house next to the ocean and you're in a stormy environment where you might have a tsunami wipe your house away, or you want to build a house next to a river that floods every now and then, it costs more for insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a higher probability. It's like build your house next to an active volcano. Probably costs more, right? That's just how insurance works. The higher the probability of something bad happening, the more it costs. This theme permeates the market because risk is also a behavior.
A behavior. Do explain. What do you mean by that?
Think about what you just said about Credit Suisse.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a history of being more aggressive as bankers,
yeah,
right? Taking on riskier positions in the business.
Yeah.
Right? So well, this history of higher risk behavior, which has led to profits at times and losses mm-hmm. at other times. But in this case, they were too far, like, here's a silly way to look at it. They were too far out over their skis. And when something bad happened, they couldn't save it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They crashed.
Right.
And in this case, they crashed and the skis went flying everywhere and the hat came off and the gloves. And, you know, it was they just did a full yard sale, tumbling down this hill. And UBS comes along and says, well, we're going to pick up the skis and the poles. I don't know where your sunglasses went. We're just going to have to give up on that and move on, right? And that's kind of how it worked, is they're in cleanup mode.
Yeah.
And this is really interesting because we'll talk maybe a little bit on the show. Like a little later, we'll talk about cocoa bonds
because mm-hmm.
that's going to be in the news. You want to hear about that. But wasn't it just high-risk behaviors in the end? Like from a banking perspective,
yeah.
they leaned too hard into certain areas and then it came back to bite them?
I think that's part of it. And I think one of the things that a lot of people aren't talking about, and I saw this on the news, they were breaking down a timeline of all of the mistakes this bank has made over the years that led up to the moment that the bank went under, right? And so, yeah, it was a combination of bad loans, but it's like, look at the track record of who you're investing in, right? Like, look at the corporation itself and say, are these the people that I should be investing in? And if you look back and look at the timeline, there's a lot of evidence that said this might not have been the best place to be investing.
Well, if you look at the timeline, I think as investors, and I'm thinking investors different than banker,
mm-hmm.
right? The investor is yeah. the person that says, should you have bought shares in this bank?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can look back on it over the last probably few years and go, well, they kept kind of doing these things that were increasing the exposure to
right.
something
and
like
they
this
were increasing
happening.
Their own liability, their own risk.
Yeah.
There was a lot of settlements where they had to pay a ton of money out because they had either done some illegal criminal activity and they were fined for it. And so they were losing money from making bad decisions. And then in the end, there was some bad loans and that's the result.
Right. So we need to unpack banks a little bit.
Okay.
Banks live in a funny land, and I want to help our listeners to understand this because banks do not operate the way that you or I operate, nor do they operate the way the government operates. Which
how do they operate then?
I
want to know.
Okay, so we'll do this. We're going to come back.
All right.
We're going to unpack this as a concept. How do banks operate? Like how do they use their money and the things that look different to them than they do to us?
Okay.
It'll all make sense. Stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it's the True Wealth Show. We're back. Excited to be here. If you're just joining us, Matt, there's a podcast, right?
Yeah, you should hit up our website, littlejohnfs.com, and go to the podcast section and check it out.
Yep, it's under the Knowledge Center, if you were curious. And I think you can also just scroll down on the homepage until you
mm-hmm.
find it.
Yep.
Because our goal is to make this really easy. Today, we are unpacking four-letter words. Right? Bank and risk. And really, we're going to focus on risk, but we're talking about it in the banking system. Why? Because that's what everybody's talking about. So first, let me ask you, Matt,
mm-hmm.
do you think the banking system is going to collapse?
I do not, because I don't think we'll allow it to collapse. It's in no one's best interest for banks to fail. Like,
yeah.
We all have our money there. We all want it to win.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a great example of sort of capitalism at large,
mm-hmm.
right? That at the end of the day, I hear people get into partisan bickering, right? The idea of like your team, my team.
And I don't
like,
know that that applies in this situation.
I don't think it. There are certain things that we actually all agree that we want, even if we disagree with how we get there initially.
So, yeah, we all want access to the money that we have in our bank accounts.
You know, we all. I mean, there are some basics that are easy. Like we all want clean air and water. We all want the ability to feed ourselves and our families, right? We all want certain basic levels of security. How we get there, we don't all agree with, right? Some people are more on the side of let's, you know, kind of all put it in the pot together and divide it up. Other people are like, well, you know, based on what, you know, you earn and so forth. I get it. And then out of that, it's spiders to infinity. Here's the reality. We all want the banking system to work.
Yeah.
Right? We actually do. Because imagine if you tried to do every transaction with cash. Okay. And there are some people out there like, oh, that's what I do. Okay. All right. Now try to do a transaction.
Your house burns down and all of your money burned down with it. Now try.
Yeah. I mean, there's some of them. Then you could say, well, I'll put it in a safe somewhere else. Right. I'll still divide it up and into different stashes. Those are all real things. But what happens when you need to pay for something over the phone?
Right.
Right. You know, what happens when you can't walk in and use cash because it's somewhere else?
Yeah. Do you want to go to the city and pay your electric bill?
And what some people may say is, yeah, I'm willing to do that. But you're the exception, not the norm. If you're living in Hermit Town, USA, like everybody leave me alone. First of all, I think being a hermit ends up being bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you are left to nothing but your own thoughts, you can spiral into dark places. I think we actually need each other. Even introverts do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's part of what was made COVID so awful. Right? Is the compartmentalization of people for a while and look at the results later. The your team, my team stuff that came out of it.
Right.
So, but that's a side note. Okay. The reality is we want the banking system to survive. Because it facilitates all these transfers of convenience, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same way if you put life on a credit card, I mean, like using it as a convenience spend, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about Amazon? How are you going to use Amazon with cash?
Right.
Right? Doesn't even work, right? Amazon, I've never paid cash for anything on Amazon. I have to have an intermediary that facilitates the money getting transferred. You can't buy stuff online with cash.
Right.
So if that's the case, we want the system to survive. I say this about capitalism too. Most people will say like, I don't like capitalism, except that they don't realize that the parts of that they want require capitalism to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't like capitalism, but I sure like to pick the color shirt I'm wearing. Well, that option comes with capitalism, right? Otherwise, you get a uniform.
Yep.
And I hope it fits you, right? That's kind of how that works. So anyway, why risk, Matt? Like, why do we have to talk about that term so much in finance?
Well, I think part of it is setting expectations, right? Where you might say, hey, I want a ton of return. I want all the return, but I don't want any of the risk. How do you make that happen, David?
Yeah,
and then you're going to,
unicorns.
There you go. So I think part of it is saying, you know what, where am I at on the risk spectrum so that I can establish, you know, what type of return is realistic or the other way around. I need this type of return. So what type of risk do I have to take in order to get there?
Yeah. It's such a common thing that, so let's talk just briefly about the various ways that the term risk gets thrown around in finance.
Mm-hmm.
In the last segment, we talked about risk from a insurance perspective. That's how much do I have to calculate in reserves to pay for a risk? Okay, that's an actuarial calculation of risk. You just talked about an investor's version of risk, mm-hmm. right? How much reward can I expect for the amount of risk that I'm taking? Risk can also be a measurement of volatility.
Mm-hmm.
How much fluctuation do I expect in my investment?
Right.
Significant fluctuation or very little of fluctuation? That is a subset of risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Risk can be time delineated or not, right? Risk can be how much loss you experience on a permanent basis or not, right? So risk can be a variable that goes into a calculation model. Like if you're looking at, for example, the capital asset pricing model for developing stock price, risk is the amount of volatility that you are having to pay for above a set rate.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, if we choose a 10-year treasury as a risk-free rate, then what's the amount of risk that one must accept in order to be compensated for not getting the risk-free rate?
I think in simple terms, what you're saying is, like, say the U.S. Treasury, say you could go get a bond at 6%. And would you want to go invest in a stock that historically never has made any type of return, right? Like, you could risk-free go get the 6%. Would you want to invest in a stock that loses 2% every year for the last 20 years?
Or let me phrase it an even different way than that. What level of return must a stock give me for me to be willing to take on that stock instead of the risk-free bond?
Right.
It needs to pay me more.
Right.
Because it's not guaranteed. Now, this is totally relevant, by the way, talking about what has happened with several banks lately. Okay. This is setting up such a great 101 investment heads up kind of course, because let's start with Silicon Valley Bank.
Mm-hmm.
It's now been 10 days
since
that went
down.
I mean, it was basically a week ago Friday.
Yeah.
And we've since learned, what are some of the key factors, right? We learned that they were heavily concentrated in the venture capital environment.
Yep. We learned that most of the investments were over the $250,000 FDIC insured limit.
Right. And then we learned that there was the equivalent of a run on the bank triggered by some investor groups, right? There were some venture capital groups that advised the companies they were working with to pull their assets. And they essentially created a run on the bank.
Yep.
And after that occurred, the bank did not have adequate assets. It was exacerbated by the fact that their reserves were invested in bonds that had lost money because rates had gone up. And so the bank didn't have enough money to pay for everybody when the run came and stay legally solvent.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, there has been government or quasi-government intervention on behalf. The Fed is not really the government. FDIC is not the government. But they're quasi-ish, right? You know, they're directed by, they have people that are appointed by government, and so where they answer to Congress. And so they have to intervene to stabilize the banking system. What happened to bondholders versus stockholders versus account holders in Silicon Valley Bank?
The people that were holding accounts there and had money invested at the bank were made whole, regardless of the amounts that they had invested.
And just so our listeners can keep track of this, I'm gonna make one subtle but important addition to that phrase. The account holders that had money deposited at the bank, they're not investors in the bank. Like, putting your money in a bank, you're not investing in it.
Right.
That's a deposit. The bank is expected to hold that securely and return it to you on demand. Right. The only time it's not on demand is if you agree to a timed deposit, like a certificate of deposit, where you will leave it for that period of time in exchange for a stated amount of interest.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how banks operate. So it's an on demand, give me my money. That's not an investment. That's a deposit.
If you had it deposited at the bank, you were made whole.
Right. So depositors were covered, even those that had accounts higher than the FDIC covered.
Mm-hmm.
This has created a whole big stink, by the way, and I understand. If you're one of those people that's like, that's some nonsense right now, that I could think of colorful four-letter words in addition. We won't say them on air, right? But that's a load of hooey that FDIC just basically waived everything and said, you know what, we're going to bail out the folks that had way too much money. I mean, that folks had tons of money in the bank. We don't care that they're wealthy or anything else. We don't care that that bank was bad behavior and high risk. They made them whole anyway, and everybody goes, wait a second. All right, that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But consider the consequences of if they had not been made whole, what might that have done to the faith in the banking system at large if people lost massive amounts of money?
People would have been rattled, right? It could have caused more runs on the bank. that's different
the
banks.
Key. Yeah. That, I think that is the key, is that the banking system itself needed the we need confidence in a banking system.
But the shareholders, they paid a little bit differently.
So why does the share, and so shareholders and bondholders, they look the different experience too.
Yeah.
Why are they different? So first of all, the shareholder, what makes the difference between a shareholder and a bondholder?
Well, they're the lowest on the totem pole to receive any type of capital upon like failure of the company. So the shareholders were the lowest man on the totem pole. Bondholders were a step above them.
So we're gonna unpack some of this a little bit more, because this is for everybody that's an investor out there. I want you to understand this key concept, because it undergirds all investments in some form or fashion. It's something we call the capital structure.
Ooh.
Okay. Sounds fancy, not complicated. If you want to know what the heck I'm talking about, hang on. We'll be right back. But we got to take our obscene profit break first. All right. So stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
And Matt,
yes,
we've been talking about debt today. We've been talking about, well, not debt in this traditional, we were talking about banks, we were talking about risk, and we were talking at the break about, and everybody's yawning a little bit, but this, you care
it's
about
gonna
this.
It's going to get interesting
if
here in
you'll,
a moment.
You'll care. It's about to all tie together in a weird way, because we have seen, right, about 10 days ago, Silicon Valley Bank dies, basically. And then we're seeing what happens after a bank dies, like who's getting sort of made whole and who's not. And now we've watched the same thing happen in Switzerland, right, with UBS picking up
Credit Suisse.
Credit Suisse.
Biggest competitor.
And this one, that gets really interesting, but I got to tell you something else to tell you about that.
Okay.
What, first, who gets paid back? We talked about the capital structure.
Yeah.
Okay? And if a bank goes under, okay, what's supposed to happen?
Well, first, anyone that has secured debt within that bank would...
Well, first, depositors, right? We didn't talk about that. But if you got money in the bank, you're supposed to get made whole at least up to your FDIC insurance limits.
Yep.
Okay, which is why we talk about with our customers, how much money are you putting into banks above those thresholds?
Right.
And might you be able to structure accounts in different ways to increase the amount of coverage you have by the FDIC?
Right.
Okay. So that's step one. But we're not talking about the depositors anymore. We're going to talk about investors and bondholders. The bank is no longer going to be a bank. Who's going to get paid back?
So
like, what's the order?
Yeah. So the first person would be the people with secured debt. So like, say the bank has a mortgage out for the building. That person that carries that mortgage is going to be made whole first out of the gate.
And if you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, why would a bank that gives out loans have a mortgage? That's a fair question. But remember, this doesn't just apply to banks.
Right. This
any
is any
company that were to go out of business is going to have to look at their capital structure.
Where's the money loaned
out? Who's going to get paid back first? And so
secured
borrowers first.
Yep.
Right. So or for secured lenders get paid back. Right. So if you loan the money to an organization and you have collateral, you're going to get to use the collateral first. If you're in the first lien position, right, the lien means that collateral is pledged to you and you're first in line to get it if something goes wrong.
If I remember right, I think below that, the second person in line would be the ones with the unsecured debts.
Yeah. And just so you know, there may be levels of secured debt, right?
Sure.
You can have a second lien position, meaning, well, once somebody gets paid back, then I'm next in line, right?
Right.
So there, that's part of this capital structure.
But after all of that, that's when we start to get into the person that has the bond.
Right. So, yeah.
So you have issued basically a loan. We're going to call it that for simple terms.
Right.
You are loaning them money. You're going to be the next person that gets paid out.
And then you can get into weird hybrid securities like preferred stock, which is sort of like a bond, but it is subordinated to other debt.
Right.
Okay. And so that's a term to know, is that if you are subordinated to other people, that means you're further back in line to get paid back.
Yeah.
What typically happens is you get paid more. Why would you get paid more if you had subordinated debt?
Maybe because you had agreed to a like higher rate of return on the investment that you had initially given.
It's because you are in a riskier position. If you're further back in line, in order to incentivize you to purchase this, to make this loan, right, which is what the preferred stock still kind of is, you would need to get paid better because you're taking on more risk. It's back to that risk-reward relationship, right?
Yeah.
And then finally, if there's anything left...
This goes back to my lowest man on the totem pole comment.
Then the shareholder might get the scraps.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it works the opposite when everything's really great. Okay. When a company is doing fantastic and it is growing in value, the shareholder has taken on the greatest risk and would expect the greatest return in value.
Right.
And these are the stories of Berkshire Hathaway. These are the stories of Microsoft and Apple and the people that got in early back in the 1980s. And, you know, they had $2,000 investments that are worth, you know, $15 million today.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, they're so lucky. It's like, yes, but they also lightning struck.
Well, and they took the most risk.
That's the issue. They could have lost it all.
Yeah, because if the company was to fall apart, they're the last ones to get paid out. So they got paid more
so
for that risk.
The high risk, high reward investment, that's exactly what's going on. Okay. And all of this to now turn our attention for a moment to what happened that was really interesting, but potentially concerning in the Credit Suisse UBS deal.
Well, and I know what happened.
Yeah, and let me be really clear to our listeners. I am not quite sure what the ramifications of this will be.
I know.
But it's not trivial. The numbers are staggering. So what happened, Matt?
Well, people had loaned money out as a bond, right? And they're called CoCo bonds, which stands for contingent convertible bonds.
And let's call them
CoCo.
Capital instruments.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, that's really what we're calling them.
That's true.
They're bonds.
They're bond-ish.
But they're bond-ish is a better description. Yeah. So
these aren't the traditional bonds that you're used to here.
Yeah.
This is more of a European thing, if I'm correct.
Well, they came post 2008. There's something called Additional Tier 1 bonds, or AT1 bonds.
Yep, yep.
They're nicknamed CoCo bonds.
Sure.
This is because banks needed to have enough reserves on hand.
They're contingent convertible, meaning they can be converted from a bond to equity.
Right. But the way it happens isn't like you might think. A lot of the time, maybe you've heard of this before, a preferred stock, which is, it behaves like a bond. It's issued at a stated price. Mm-hmm. It pays a stated interest rate, but there's no specific maturity date.
Right.
Okay. It's kind of like a line of credit, right? That a company can offer, and it doesn't have a date where it matures.
But the person is like acting as the line of credit, is what you're saying.
Well, if you buy a preferred instrument, like a preferred stock, then you're essentially making a loan without an end date.
Yes.
Right? Now, typically, there are reclamation. There are points in time where you can redeem those bonds and you can get back out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's not uncommon to have preferred shares, and they're still liquid-ish. Like, you can get out at certain times. But the idea is that they are not a stock, nor are they a traditional bond.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these are convertible preferred bonds. And the incentive is, hey, make a loan to the company, be in a safer position on the capital structure. But if the company shoots up in value, you may want to choose to convert your preferred stock into common stock and then become a shareholder of the company, and you'll make the value in the appreciation of the stock price. So that's an interesting animal. The AT1 bond, or the CoCo bond that was going on in Europe, remember what happened in 2008?
Yeah, banks failed.
Right? And they failed because they didn't have enough capital.
Mm-hmm. So this was a way for banks to have more capital.
Because they work in reverse of what you would expect a convertible, like a preferred convertible stock to work like. If the bank is going backwards and they're in trouble and they need more capital to shore up the balance sheet,
they can tap into that amount.
The CoCo bonds, these AT1 bonds, they convert.
It's their fallback.
Yeah. So this is a tripwire where if you go backwards too far, these stop being bonds-like instruments and they become common stock.
Right.
And what happens when a bank goes out of business to the stockholder?
Their share prices are worth virtually nothing.
Yeah. They get hosed because the shareholder is last in line. So what happened is anybody that owned these bonds could have potentially just been booted to the back of the line and watched their equity position and their where they were in the capital structure blow up all at the same time.
Right. And so what we witnessed was what happened to the share price. They were trading at $10 or something a share. What are they trading at now? Less than $1 a share, 90-something cents.
Yeah. So huge collapse there. And part Credit of, Suisse is being acquired by UBS, which means
the structure of the takeover included a write down of all of the AT1 bonds. And by that, what I mean is
they're just going to disappear.
They're going to default. Yeah. So, and if we look at how much money was in those bonds, $17 billion with a B.
Oh, I'm seeing something even more terrifying.
Oh, no.
Well, because the entire market for AT1s is a $275 billion market.
Right. So they wrote off $17 billion.
So if they write off $17 billion, what happens to all of the other investors that are in this capital instrument? Will they be willing to hold it any longer?
And that is the concern. And that's
Will this create a different run on the bank, a run on the reserve capital, could then destabilize that system?
And that's what they're theorizing might be happening in the weeks to come.
Yeah. And so that is quite concerning.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there is a really novel, albeit kind of slick, dare I say, maybe even a little bit dirty solution to this.
Oh, really?
There is.
I want to know.
Well, I'll share it. I'm not saying it's a good solution, but we'll wait until after this break. Stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 939 and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right, so I promised all of our listeners the dirty solution to the banking problem.
Yeah, how do we prevent or dodge the bullet of all of these, you know, AT1 type bondholders from saying, hey, ooh, this one failed, I want all my money?
So this is, I'm not advocating for this solution. I'm simply saying that
it's a possibility.
It's not off the table.
Okay.
So we're used to thinking about financial solutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've got to go in and figure out how to get capital here or there. We got to, you know, tinker with interest rates. We're going to have to do all these other things. But there is something else that could be done, which is we could tinker with the regulatory policy itself.
Okay.
Right. Let's talk about the just so you know, I am not an expert in bank policy, but understand that you have not only the reserve requirements of the bank, but those reserve requirements get set by the FDIC and I think FDIC and the Federal Reserve. I think Federal Reserve, they set lending rates between banks, and they can set reserve requirements. So,
like how much money you have to
have on reserve. But the Federal Reserve can do something else. They have their own balance sheet, and they have the ability to extend or contract their own credit facility, their own window of liquidity. So they could have simply said in the example of Silicon Valley Bank, well, why don't we change the reserve requirement to say that for a temporary injunction, we'll provide 30 days of liquidity at essentially zero interest for 30 days. And then in day 31, it would be retroactive interest. As long as you get it paid back within 30 days, you're good. They could have handled the entire run on the bank, and they could have bought themselves time to facilitate or even modify the reserve requirement itself and said, well, you don't need 33% in these assets. You need 32% in these assets. Magically, it was solved, right, with the stroke of a pen rather than destroying a bank. I think you run a risk that if you do that, that you're basically saying, well, we'll bail you out of bad behaviors.
Yeah, we'll just invent wiggle room every time there needs to be
some
wiggle room.
And so I'm not advocating for that solution. It's a dirty pool solution because it's basically saying let's remove or modify the rules so the consequences aren't consequences anymore.
Yeah.
That's a bad idea, just so we're clear. But it is something that does exist and is on the table and could potentially occur in Switzerland. Right?
Right.
I mean, there are still potentially ways that the European Central Bank, in cooperation with these super banks, which realistically we hate the term, but may be too big to fail, because if they fail, the cascade effect of the dominoes knocking one institution, knocks over the next, could sort of implode the banking system. So where does the risk ultimately get transferred? To where a printing press exists, right? So the risk gets shuffled around until you've got some way to absorb the risk in the system, to buy time, and then to regulate differently to try to prevent it in the future. Because that's the one thing about capitalism. It's so dang clever.
It just invents ways to stay alive.
Yeah, it just, yeah, you close a door, they find an open window, right? It's just water looking to fill in the gaps and the creases and find its way through, and it's relentless.
Mm-hmm.
So that's both good and bad, right? It's relentless in that it will find excesses and you will develop bubbles and they will pop. But it's also relentless in that you can try to contain it and it will find a way out. It's going to find a solution. And so I'm convinced that the very things that got us into this problem will be the same things that ultimately get us out. Is the system is desperate to survive, right? It's desperate to keep working. And as a result, I think it will.
Look at that little shot of optimism. I appreciated that.
Yeah. And so thanks.
Yeah.
I think there may be a lot more opportunity buried in this market than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
I think Warren Buffett says it really well when he says, you should be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. Consider the behavior of our government and the extraordinary lengths they went through during things like COVID to save the system, even at potentially the cost of the system in some way. I mean, but, you know, it wasn't a let's kick the can down the road. It was a let's drop kick the economy down the road to try to make this thing work and we'll solve it later. I believe that that incentive is still there, and it's not just in the United States. I think that is a global incentive. And while there are those that would like to rewrite the source code of our, you know, the operating system of humanity, human nature is not going to change. And they may like to rewrite the operating system of all the different countries. And, you know, I hear the conspiracy around the World Economic Forum and so forth. even if that were true, it's not in their best interest to destroy the system that protects the capital that they rely upon to manipulate the system.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would suggest that there may be less conspiracy than there is the theory of complacency and incompetency that drove some of this, but I think it's going to be solvable too.
Yeah.
So anyway, we do not, to my knowledge, have a financial term today.
Oh,
I know.
I was really looking forward to one too.
You know, it's funny because we should have cocoa bonds would have been a great one to say true or false. Is it real?
Right, because it sounds like you're talking about Cocoa Puffs, in which I would have been like, come on, man, that's not real.
Yeah, but Cocoa Bonds are a real thing.
You know what?
Cocoa Puffs, they might be false.
You know what? Let's just add that to the term. Let's just throw it up on the website. We'll put Cocoa Bonds
Bonds, which are a real, not a financial term, but it falls under the category of sounds fake and isn't. Cocoa Bonds, love it. Look, as we get to the end of the hour, I want to encourage all of you. I realize that there's a lot of risks and a lot of ways to view risk in the system. You do not have to do this alone. Okay, if you would like a second opinion or would just like a look at what you're doing, some advice, there's no obligation to this, but we would be delighted to have an opportunity to speak with you. I encourage you to give us a call. Matt, how do they reach us?
541-375-0898.
All right. So with that, the music is playing and they're going to tell us to get off the air. So don't forget to grab the podcast if you want to get the rest of this stuff. Mind your P's and Q's and understand risk and reward. LittleJohnFS.com and 541-375-0898. Till next time, this has been David Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.